Funding for the Think Podcast comes from TCU, where researchers strive to develop sustainable solutions to protect the world's fresh water supply. You can learn more at endeavors.tcu.edu. Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What causes a wall of water far offshore to rise as high as an office building, even when the sky is clear and the seafloor is stable? And what would it feel like to catch and ride one of these giant swells? Sailors have told stories of rogue waves for hundreds of years, and no doubt countless others have failed to live to tell. But it wasn't until this century that scientists have been able to officially document such an occurrence, and that extreme athletes have found ways to surf the world's biggest waves just for the sheer thrill of it. Susan Casey is editor-in-chief of O, the Oprah magazine. She tells some of their stories in her latest book, out now in trade paperback, called The Wave, In Pursuit of the Rogues, Freaks, and Giants of the Ocean. Susan, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
What is the definition of a rogue wave?
Scientifically speaking, the definition is a wave that is more than two times the height of the seas around it. It can be as big as four or five times even.
Hmm. And they can get, as far as we know, as tall as close to 100 feet?
Well, yes, they definitely can. And water is a really dense substance. Waves theoretically could get much, much bigger than that. But they need a certain environment. So, you know, you're not going to get a 100-foot wave in, say, 10-foot seas. Mm-hmm. I mean, but yes, waves can get very large. In fact, I write in the book about a wave that's 1,740 feet tall.
Right. And that's the one that hit off Alaska?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So they sometimes hit that hot high when they get to shore, but not always. Is that right?
Well, so just to be clear, in the book I'm writing about all kinds of different types of giant waves, and there are several. So that one was caused by a landslide. And what it was, basically, was a giant splash. It was kind of a localized tsunami. So this mountain range was shaken by a very strong earthquake, a 9.2 earthquake, the Fairweather Range, and a giant load of rock and ice and glacier basically plunged down into very deep water. And it was, to use an analogy, imagine getting on a ladder in your bathtub and having a very deep bathtub and dropping a paving stone. And that's kind of the way that wave happened. And they know exactly how high it was because it scalped all the trees off the surrounding shorelines, which were sort of steep and narrow in this almost little fjord, so they could measure. It was like somebody came along with a razor and just scalped the edge of the forest.
Yeah, I have to say, the photographs that you include in this book are worth the price of the book itself. If you do nothing but look at the photographs, they're really extraordinary. And you see there, right on that mountain, it's basically, there's a tree line, and then it just falls off completely.
Yeah, no, it's an extraordinary image, and what's so cool about that particular event, which is a whole chapter in the book, is that there were several people that witnessed it, and a couple people who even lived through it in boats. Really extraordinary and very well documented and fascinating. It only happened in 1958. And then the scientists and the geologists that went in to look at it realized these waves happen quite regularly in that bay, these very, very anomalous giant waves. So that's one kind. That's a very exotic kind.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are rogue waves which come as a result of sort of volatility in the ocean, and they can be responsible for sort of rearing up on ships and damaging the ships to the point where the ship will sink without even having time to give a mayday. And then there are giant storm waves which are also sought after by a group of some of my favorite characters in the book, the tow surfers, who are on a global scavenger hunt to surf 100-foot waves and taller. And then, of course, tsunami is another kind of giant wave, which we've tragically seen very recently.
Now, for a long time, there were experts who suspected that descriptions of rogue waves, like the ones you talked about that sort of overtake a ship at far out to sea, were perhaps embellished by sailors who'd had ordeals with them, not maybe deliberately, but just based on the trauma of the experience itself. And then in the year 2000, there is this British research vessel, the Discovery, minding its own business off the coast of Scotland. Can you talk about what happened there?
Yes, well, it was actually, they had sort of, the equations that they used to do climate models and wave models didn't really make sense that there would be, say, a 100-foot wave and 38-foot seas.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't actually, they couldn't make it, that math add up. And so in 2000, a ship, it's obviously very hard to get accurate measurements of waves. There's a certain amount of terror involved when you see a big one. And so that was part of the reason why the accounts were never fully believed because they weren't scientifically documented. And then also, of course, a lot of people who encounter these rogue waves, they weren't coming back to tell about it. I mean, they just vanished. Mm-hmm. So the discoveries and incident in North Atlantic winter storm, which I opened the book with, was really remarkable because they were on a scientific vessel that was outfitted with wave measuring devices, and yet they weren't expecting these giant waves, and they got trapped in this vortex of giant waves that none of the models had predicted. So they couldn't be explained away. They were all documented, and it was a ship full of scientists. So that was quite extraordinary, and the paper that resulted in it, which took 6 or 7 years to write, really changed the thinking about the kinds of conditions that ships were encountering. Like, they all use these models to try to chart where to go, and it was very clear that the models were not accurate, at least in that case. And in some of the most volatile cases, the models just were not tracking with what the ocean was really doing.
I know that you finished the project on the book, and it came out last year initially. I don't know if you saw last month, the European Space Agency had documented some rogue waves from satellites.
Well, you know, it's funny. I interviewed in the book, and he's one of the characters in it, the world's foremost expert on this, and there are things that they can do to see them, and there are things they can't do. Hmm. And the measurements that they can get from space are useful, but they need, without getting really technical about it, they need one more little device so they can use the information they think they're getting, and perhaps that's what they came up with. But I knew they were close, but they hadn't done it yet.
So what are the prevailing theories of how some of these waves seem to form? And you mentioned there are sort of disruptions in the ocean. What would cause these to be so much bigger than the other waves around them?
There's a lot of different causes, and some of them we understand and some of them we don't. Under some circumstances, these waves appear and they can't be explained scientifically. Some of the conditions under which they happen, for example, when a cold storm, say coming up from Antarctica, the storm's moving and there's no land and the wind has a long distance that it can blow and put energy into the water, and then it hits a warm, fast-moving current like the Gulf Stream, say, or in this case the Agulhas Current, which comes down in the opposite direction of the Gulf Stream down the southeast coast of Africa. And it's just like this, I call it an oceanic train wreck.
Mm-hmm.
So this hot water meets this cold water. They're both very powerful. You just have this smash-up, and the waves are very steep. And as one scientist explained to me very simply and beautifully, steeper waves are farther away from equilibrium. So they're more likely to sort of go, what I call, just basically off the charts. Instead of just building up, one wave will sort of steal the energy of the waves around it and become a teetering monster, very unstable. And those are the waves that can break in the open ocean. Those are the waves that can kind of, you know, they're very misshapen. And that's why rogue and freak wave, that term is used interchangeably. And one of the hallmarks that sailors would always talk about with rogue waves was this thing called the hole in the ocean,
yeah,
which means they have an abnormally large trough. So the waves kind of, the water's getting sucked up the face in an unusual way. So they really are kind of rogues and freaks.
Hmm. How often are they truly single waves? Typically, are there some that sort of build up before them and some that come after them that are different? Or sometimes is there just one wave that acts incredibly different than the ones around?
Yes, there is. In fact, before the discovery, it can be a set. It can be a set of waves, like it could be three. Even tsunamis don't always come as a single wave. And in fact, they rarely do. But in 1995, the incident that really made things, scientists sit up at their computer terminals was, there was, in the North Sea, there was an oil rig called the Dropner oil rig, and it, on New Year's Day, it had, you know, it basically was being kind of buffeted by 38-foot waves, and then out of the blue came an 85-foot wave, and this platform had laser measurements on it. So the 85-foot wave hit, and it was measured accurately. It was a single wave, and then but that probably would have been wiped off of the data set because it was such an outlier. Sometimes when they see a spike like that, they remove it because they think it was an error. But what had happened was that the 85-foot wave had damaged the oil rig at 85 feet, so they knew the wave had been there, and that was a case of there was only one wave.
Wow. And I'm guessing there's no way to get out of the way of these things, even if you can spot one in the distance, even with equipment, right?
It doesn't appear so. And they can also, one of the things that ship captains and scientists that I spoke to told me was they can come from odd directions. I mean, one of the things that captains do in a storm is try to point their bow into the waves. And it seems counterintuitive, but it's really the only way you can survive it. You need to get, you can't get what's a surface, say, caught inside. You don't want to be underneath a breaking wave. So they have to kind of hit the crest before the wave breaks. And, you know, occasionally what will happen with a rogue wave is it'll come from a different direction. Mm-hmm. And the captain will be focusing on trying to keep his bow into the prevailing waves, and then whack, from the side, a wave will come.
And I guess I hadn't fully understood this before I read this book, but tsunamis don't necessarily cause a great disruption on the surface of the ocean far out, even if they're directly above where the Earth is moving.
Well, here's my best image for a tsunami. Imagine a wave is like a cracking of a whip.
Mm-hmm.
And a tsunami is a wave with the longest wavelength, so it's like a cracking of a whip that's really long. And so you imagine that energy just sort of humping through until it hits the shoreline. The shoreline is like, it's really like it stops the wave. So then all the energy from the long, long wavelength piles up behind it. And that's why it only really becomes devastating when it hits, encounters an obstacle, basically.
So I want to talk about giant storm waves, because some of these are somewhat predictable. We know there are certain parts of the world where they are likely to happen and certain conditions that cause them. You saw your first 40-foot wave when you were doing research for this book. Is that right?
Well, before I started writing the book, I had seen a smaller wave, like a 25-foot wave, and thought, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
During the 5 years that I spent working on the book, I saw waves much bigger than 40 feet and 50 feet. I saw waves in the 70, 75-foot range. But, yes, I mean, even a 10-foot or 20-foot wave can be absolutely terrifying.
And, I mean, how far off can you spot these?
Well, you know, everything is relative. So if you see a 20-foot wave from a mile away, it's not going to look like much. I happened to be in the water when I saw this 20-foot wave, and so, I mean, one of the waves that is very famous and plays a big role in the book is a wave in Maui on the North Shore called Jaws, and Jaws, a lot of people, when it's very big, when it's 60, 70, 80 feet, will come to this cliff that's about probably 2/3 a mile offshore and watch it, and even from there it can be pretty dramatic.
And so a featured character in the book is this surfer, Laird Hamilton, who is really an amazing guy. You spent a lot of time with him. He and his colleagues have found a way to catch these waves.
That's right. They invented their own sport because at about 40 feet, the wave just becomes too big and it's moving too fast for a surfer to paddle into it, you know, lying down on their stomach, paddling with their hands. I sort of compare it to trying to catch the subway by crawling. You know, it's just not going to happen. So Laird was so uniquely focused on riding waves that were much, much bigger than that, that he invented the means to do so, including invented all new gear. These surfboards that they use to ride these giant waves are very small and pointed, and they have foot straps like a snowboard, and they're very heavy. So they basically have some stability without the friction of surface area. And then they use jet skis and water ski tow ropes to tow one another onto the waves, and they sort of fling them onto the wave just as the wave's building, and then they let go and they can ride a wave that they otherwise wouldn't be able to catch.
Hmm. The timing of that, I mean, I know the timing is amazing when you're paddling out as well, but it's like so many more people involved in the process.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot of safety protocols for something like that. You need people who are going to rescue you. You need to feel, I mean, and nobody really wants to ride a 100-foot wave and, you know, by themselves. So there's helicopters with photographers in them. And to see the days when there are these kinds of waves and there are men, and it is basically all men at this point, riding them, you know, it's a bit of a, it's like an expedition. It's a very intense thing. And one of the first times I ever went to a very big day on the West Coast at a wave called Mavericks, you know, three people died. Mm. So there's obviously very high stakes involved.
Susan Casey is my guest. She is editor-in-chief of O, the Oprah magazine, and author of the book The Wave, In Pursuit of the Rogues, Freaks, and Giants of the Ocean. The phone lines are open now. You can join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is editor-in-chief of O, the Oprah magazine, Susan Casey. Her new book is called The Wave, In Pursuit of the Rogues, Freaks, and Giants of the Ocean. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Susan, you mentioned before the break how incredibly dangerous this is, and I think people can understand that. But one thing that might surprise readers is that none of the people you profile here appears to have this thing that maybe non-adventurers imagine to be a death wish. Everybody really wants to stay alive while doing this.
I mean, they're actually the most alive people I've ever met. I mean, because they really are aware of everything around them. They're very alert, and they're very present. I mean, Laird thinks that people ask him all the time, they ask me, too, is he crazy? And he thinks, he thinks it's crazy to sit behind a desk all day. That's his definition.
Okay, so talk about how your senses are involved when you are riding one of these waves. You have to get inside the barrel. Like, what does a surfer have to notice to sort of manage himself or herself and stay safe?
Well, few surfers can get inside the barrel of a 100-foot wave because that's where the pit of the wave is and where the most energy is. And a lot of the times on these giant waves, surfers will just go right down the shoulder, which is out in front of where the wave is breaking. And that itself is daunting enough. Laird is one of the only surfers who will go into the barrel of a giant, giant wave. But I think what happens to them, and I asked a number of them to try to get this sensation, and even on a smaller wave, you can kind of feel it, is there's just so much energy there. And you feel it through your feet, through your board, through your body. And, the wave, the energy that made that wave when it's that big is just so incredibly humbling. And there is no sense of, hey, did I leave the stove on? You know, they're so present. I believe it's the feeling that people meditate for 30 years to get. And also at that moment, the body in its sort of wisdom squirts out a lot of very potent chemicals that I think are quite dramatic and an experience to have. I think they're all pretty much, to surf giant waves is a bit of an addiction, a bit of a calling, and a bit of a choice.
Does it sound different inside the barrel of a wave?
Well, everybody says it's different. It's a pastiche of sensory experiences. There might be some sound, there might be light, there might be flashes of light, there might be water, but really what there is just this, this deep being in the absolute moment. A couple of people have said to me, what is that moment? That's the moment where you're in the zone, where anything can really happen. There's a sense of if you're that present, it's when the mother can lift the car off the baby, you know.
Now, you have a background as an elite athlete, which I gather helped a lot when you were working on the book. How do surfers in particular train when they're not in the water?
Well, Laird Hamilton is very unique in that he trains very hard. A lot of surfers don't do that. There's different things they can do. One of the things Laird does that I think is very unique to him is he does huge endurance work. He rides bikes. He pulls a very heavy log through sand with a harness. And then he has a workout that he does where he has a very deep pool, and he has all these weights on the bottom of the pool, like 30, 40, 50-pound weights, and he does exercises with the weights underwater, which, I've done this workout, and it's pretty daunting. Your heart rate shoots through the roof, and, you're underwater with these weights. And he's really legendary for how hard he trains, but not every surfer does that. One of the things that I've been hyper aware of is just to keep your neck very strong, because you can be whipsawed around so much, and the neck really is kind of a weak link, and obviously that's something that could be very, very detrimental to keeping your career longevity would be if your neck somehow weakened.
Do they wear goggles?
Oh, no. I mean, when you see the force of these waves, it would be ripped off your head so fast, and they do wear flotation vests, which the thing about the flotation vests, they're very streamlined but very dense neoprene, and so they do help bring you to the surface when tremendous forces are pinning you down. And I mean, I can imagine, I've never fallen on a 70-foot wave, but I likened it, after talking to a lot of people who had, to being an underwater bomb blast.
Yeah.
It is really what it is. And so occasionally they'll get declothed. Their flotation vests will be blown off, and their double shoulder dislocations. And, you know, some surfer will come to the surface completely naked and bleeding. And I mean, anything can happen on a 70-foot wave if you fall.
And you were hurt very seriously with a much smaller wave.
Right. And one of my, the moment where I had such a great appreciation for the power of a wave was when I was surfing one time on, you know, a head high wave and ended up in the hospital. They're just so powerful. One of my favorite statistics in the book that I wrote and the editor questioned was it only takes an 18-inch wave to topple a wall built to withstand 125 mile per hour winds.
Wow.
And the editor wrote me a note back saying, well, surely you mean 18 feet. Well, no, it's 18 inches. It's just so dense and so powerful.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Susan Casey, author of The Wave, In Pursuit of the Rogues, Freaks, and Giants of the Ocean. Let's go to Ken in Garland. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Yeah, I had a question, a fascinating subject. I've been trying to get my brain around a fact that maybe Ms. Casey could help me understand, is that how a wave can travel at 500 miles an hour out in the open ocean, and how big of a displacement of the seafloor might that take to cause something like that to happen?
Well, George, you're speaking of a tsunami in that case. And they, as I said, they're really long wavelength waves. So if you imagine, if I had a rope and you stood 10 miles away and we basically whipped the rope like we were, you know, cracking a whip, you could imagine how fast that could move. And water, energy travels through water, you know, water conducts energy very well. So that's how tsunamis do travel at the speed of jets. And they're not caused by every disruption. It needs to be a vertical disruption. There needs to be a certain displacement vertically. So there's certain kinds of earthquakes that will cause a tsunami and certain kinds that won't. And likewise with a landslide, you know, it's just a massive motion. If you imagine getting in a bathtub and taking a piece of, say, plexiglass or something and shoving a bunch of water forward, like, you can see how you could create that kind of disruption. It's actually quite simple, but it is hard for people to wrap their head around the fact that when a wave is traveling that fast, the water itself isn't actually moving. The energy is actually moving.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Denton, and we'll speak with Kim. Hi, Kim.
Hello. I have a question. When I was living in Chicago, I was born and raised there. I remember, I believe it was in the 70s, there was a tsunami in Lake Michigan, and I was wondering how often that occurs. And I remember it so vividly because it was such a freak occurrence. And, in fact, fishermen that were sitting on the seawall fishing were swept out to the middle of the lake and drowned.
I actually am not aware of that incident. It sounds totally fascinating. I have never heard of a tsunami in a lake, but, you know, I don't know that it couldn't. Certainly must have happened. You know, to a certain extent, tsunamis can be related to storm surges. They can somehow, it can be the water level rises very quickly. But I'm not aware of that incident. Wow.
So, Susan, we spoke earlier about the incredible need for trust between team members. You need to know the people who are working with you in this tow surfing are very competent. You're responsible for the lives of other people, but even the most experienced teams can be bested by these things. Can you tell us a little bit about Brett Lickle?
Well, one of the most harrowing incidents in the book was when Brett and Laird went out on a day when they thought they would maybe encounter 40-foot waves. And it was not a very good day. There was very little visibility, and so thus there was nobody out there with them, and they didn't even have their safety crew or anything. They didn't expect much.
Mm-hmm.
And then they got there, and really what they got was the most extraordinary day that had ever come to them in their lives, and waves topping 100 feet. And without giving away what happens at that time, you know, they got into a place where they were really fighting for their lives, even the very best in the world at that point. And I think they both escaped, you know, by the skin of their teeth. And when you see the resulting, when I saw the resulting trauma and the injury and and everything, and I heard them talk about that. It unfolded over quite a while when I sort of downloaded all the details on it. It was a life and death experience for sure. The ocean, no matter how good you are, no matter how strong you are, no matter how prepared you are, there is just no way that you can stand in front of a 100-foot wave and think, I'm in charge here.
Yeah.
You aren't.
How often do they get out there and say, you know what, this is too much, I got to turn around?
It has happened. With Laird, it doesn't happen very much. Because Laird is really preparing for, as he says, for the day that nobody's seen before.
Mm-hmm.
He really is. He's so unique in that way. Like, he is uniquely qualified for that day. And that's what he's waiting for, as a matter of fact. There might be a day when the conditions are not right, say the wind isn't right, where it becomes too dangerous. Say an onshore wind, which means the wind is coming from behind the wave, can be very dangerous because it can make the wave close out quickly, and then the surfer gets trapped sort of in the white water in the breaking wave, and that's a very, you know, basically you're just gobbled up by it. So they watch for conditions, and there are probably situations where that are just, they may not be too big, but they're just too dangerous.
What sort of regard do the surfers and the scientists have for one another?
I don't know that there's a lot of interaction between them, and that's what one of the things I was trying to do is I wanted to get anybody who could take me onto a 100-foot wave, you know, both literally and metaphorically, so that I could, by extension, take readers there to this place where very few people have ever been, maybe a handful, and live to tell about it. Well, meanwhile, you know, 2,000 people have been up to the top of Everest. So the scientists had one set of experiences about it, and most of them don't go out to sea. The Discovery was kind of an exception to that rule, and Penny Holliday, this female scientist who I absolutely adored and spent quite a lot of time with, she had a lot to say about what it was like being in 100-foot waves, and of course the surfers do as well. But they, as far as I know, never really interacted. They were all fascinated to read about one another in the book.
What's going on under the surface of the water when there is a gigantic wave on the surface?
Well, it's funny. You know, you go under the surface of a giant wave and things are not that different than anywhere else. It's like the energy is sort of there and you can feel it, but it's not breaking in any way. I mean, there's basically a building up of energy. In the case of a wave that the surfers might be riding, there is a reef or a, in the case of some waves on the California coast, a set, like almost an underwater mountain range, there is something that's helping the wave break. So you may encounter that. But you can duck, as most surfers know, you can duck dive right into a wave, and you're relatively safe right below it.
What does it take to learn how to surf in the first place?
Just perseverance and good conditions, and I think it helps, and I think Laird would agree, to be comfortable in the water, and that's what really helped me in reporting this book, because I had spent so long training as a open water and competitive swimmer that I wasn't scared by the conditions. And I think if you're on a surfboard and you fall and you're scared, you sort of handicap yourself in the first place. You're too tight. So what Laird recommends would be just to be really comfortable in the water, work on your swimming skills before you surf, and then just start surfing. It's so fun. Even the smallest waves can be fun to surf. I mean, what these guys are doing, I compare them to, what they are to regular surfers really are what astronauts are to pilots. So it's not quite the same thing at all.
But they were pretty accepting of you, or did it take several sort of trips out with them to feel like you were part of their group?
Well, for me, it always takes years. I mean, both my books have taken me 5 years to write because I really do want to immerse myself in the culture that I'm writing about, and I don't start writing until I feel I'm ready. And I'm really a part of it in a granular way where they almost forget I'm writing a book. So it didn't take that long, but you win trust over for me anyway, you win it over years. They may like you, they may accept you, but it's really, for me, it's the time is really what makes for the richness in the story.
And I guess the other thing you have to do is ensure, I mean, you're in great condition, you have all this experience, and you want that because you don't want to feel like you're hindering whatever it is they're trying to do.
Absolutely. I never wanted to put them in danger by having to watch out for me. And I think that is part of the reason why they accepted me, is they knew that I was going to be able to handle it out there, and I hoped that I would never be in a position where I had to be rescued or something. But I have had several conversations with Laird where I said, I really want to go And if something happens to me, you know, you don't have to worry about it. And he just laughed at me. He was like, as if we're going to not do that. I mean, that is their ethos is they'll rescue whoever needs rescuing. Mm-hmm. And it could be somebody who they don't even know. But when you get 10 tow teams out there on a day when there are these waves and it's dangerous, they all look out for one another. It's really quite an incredible thing to watch. When a surfer goes down and doesn't come up right away, every jet ski goes in looking for him.
Mm. Do they have to communicate with one another to make sure that they're not sending people out into a limited space? I mean, how close are these teams to one another?
Oh, there's an incredible amount of jockeying.
Uh-huh.
And there's a movie that Laird and some of his cohorts made called Crazy Train, Riding the Crazy Train. And it talks about this really crowded day on Jaws. And if you watch that movie, you can see how there's literally ropes, tow ropes crisscrossing as they go on the wave. But nobody... really, somebody's going to get it. Everybody else is going to back off. So it's a little bit of a game of chicken at the beginning.
Uh-huh.
And people do collide. I mean, I don't think it's very pleasant for them to surf giant, giant days that are crowded, because it's scary enough when you don't have to worry about another person coming in from the side. And there was one situation Laird had where he was on a wave and somebody somehow got in his way, and he had to straighten out. So he fell. He couldn't make it out the side before the wave broke, and the force was such that it split his lips open.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's enough to fall. He doesn't fall that often on his own accord, but somebody got in his way, and that fall could have been fatal. So that's just something that they don't like.
How did they sort of eject the board? Or you talk about flinging the board from the jet ski. Can you talk about how that works?
Well, imagine somebody on, you know, if you've ever seen wakeboarding with
uh-huh.
a boat, where there's just, you know, a person is on a little board, he's got his feet strapped down, he's holding onto a rope, and he's being towed. So the jet ski comes across the top of the wave, and the surfer just lets go. You can see this on YouTube. If you just put Laird Hamilton in there on YouTube, and you'll see tow surfing in action. You'll see how they get dropped off right as the wave starts to build, and then when they're on the wave, there's so many G-forces that they don't want their feet to be loose. So they at least will have toe straps. Laird uses heel and toe straps, but that gives them a lot more stability and ability to torque around on a bottom turn with 3 Gs of force. But at the same time, if he falls, there's a better chance that he's going to get whipsawed around and trapped in his board and ligaments get torn and that. And so it's a matter of personal preference, really, how much foot strapping goes on a board.
Susan Casey is my guest. She's editor-in-chief of O, the Oprah magazine. Her book is called The Wave, In Pursuit of the Rogues, Freaks, and Giants of the Ocean. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Susan Casey. She's editor-in-chief of O, the Oprah magazine, and author of the book The Wave, In Pursuit of the Rogues, Freaks, and Giants of the Ocean. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Susan, one of the fascinating things here is the reality that average wave heights are, in fact, very much on the rise. Can you talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. That there has been, through different parts of the ocean have different characteristics, of course, but right as the wave was going to press, the hardcover edition about a year ago, researchers from Oregon State released a paper saying that the 100-year wave, which is a measurement that's used coastally, and in marine installations, it's basically a unit of measurement, had risen from 33 feet to 46 feet, and by some measurements could even be up as big as 55 feet. So it was this massive increase off the northwest Pacific coast. And in the North Atlantic as well, waves had been over the from the 60s through the 90s going up by approximately 25%. And really what's happening, it seems, is that there's just, we do know that sea levels are rising. I mean, as complicated as the feedback loops and climate change can be, we know certain things are happening. And there isn't a scientist that I spoke to who doesn't think there's some sense that the ocean is becoming more volatile. Obviously, there's more water as the sea levels rise, and there's just more energy in the system. So without getting very complicated about it, extremes are getting more extreme out there. And so that means more wind. More temperature differential means more wind, and more wind means more waves. And I mean, it's all connected. The planet is all connected. And so one of the most frightening things that I discovered was that at the end of the last ice age, when there was a lot of activity of glaciers melting and sea levels rising, really the ocean plate and different plates on land masses were getting weighted and unweighted in different ways. Mm-hmm. For example, you know, there might all of a sudden be a lot more weight on a certain area of the ocean crust if there is higher sea levels. And really that kind of moving around is the definition of an earthquake. So as the last ice age ended and all the glaciers melted and water poured in to the ocean basins, there was a lot of rocking and rolling. It was a very volatile time. And even though you can't attribute any one single event to climate change, like by the time we prove it's a result of climate change, it's too late. It's like the frog in the pot. You can look all around at the craziness that's happening with weather and earthquakes. And I mean, we've had two major tsunamis in the past 8 years, to know that we're in a time of flux and change. And that will definitely have an effect on what the oceans do. The oceans are the planet.
Yeah, it really is a remarkable conclusion that, you know, you think of climate change and the things that sort of happen on the surface, and then you think of seismic activity. And it's hard to imagine that those two are related in this way. But as we warm the planet, we could cause more earthquakes.
It's very simple. It's like if you bounce if you just roll a bowling ball onto a trampoline, you can see that the bottom moves. Mm-hmm. And the bottom moving is an earthquake or a volcanic eruption. And there are volcanoes in the world that are so sensitive that if there's one drop in temperature, they'll erupt. There's some volcanoes that only erupt in the spring. Mm-hmm. And these are all, you know, things that these systems are all interconnected. So I think that the future will be very much a time of understanding and respecting and adapting to these changes, because we've lived in a very benign time.
We have an email here from Steve in Dallas who says, given that these hit particular geographical areas more frequently, could they eventually be harnessed as a power source?
Well, there's definitely people trying to use wave power, and they have wave farms, which is a phrase that absolutely delights me. I just love the idea of a wave farm. But one of the scientists who was telling me about the state of the art for wave energy told me that a lot of the problems they've had is that the wave farms get destroyed by the waves. The waves are so powerful. So I think at this moment there's some new designs that look really promising, and I do think eventually that there will be wave-based energy. I think everybody thinks that. It's just a question of how and where.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go to Catherine in Dallas. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Great show as always. I have a question for your guest. A few years ago, and this may have been 8 or 10 years ago, there was a surfing documentary that was shown actually at the Inwood Theater called Stepping into Liquid. And it was about surfing and that whole culture and what some of these folks do and the thrills that they get. One of the scenes was actually surfing behind a tanker in the Houston Ship Channel, which I thought was interesting. But the documentary culminated in this group of surfers going out somewhere in the middle of the Pacific Ocean to this known, 100-foot wave, and they were going to surf it. And they had to be dropped in, I think, like by helicopter. And I'm wondering if your guest is familiar with the documentary or this particular wave, and if she perhaps has even experienced it herself.
Yes, thank you. I am. It's called the Cortez Bank, and there's a chapter in the book that deals with an incredible episode out there. And really, that's what I was referring to earlier when I said a sunken mountain range. It's part of the Channel Islands chain, but it's just submerged. So it really creates massive waves. It's 100 miles offshore, basically from San Diego. And the problem with it is it's so exposed. The wind wrecks it a lot, and because it gets waves in 360 degrees. It's very hard for them to find a day when they can go out there and not have to worry about, say, surfing a 60-foot wave and having a 30-foot wave coming at them.
Hmm.
So it's very hard to get good conditions out there. But Laird and the other men that have surfed Cortez Bank a lot all believe that that particular spot could create, under the right conditions, a very surfable 200-foot wave. Now, could a person make it down? I mean, no one's done it, so they don't know. But that doesn't mean someone's not going to try.
Are there particular techniques, Susan, for, you know, if you have the misfortune to wipe out and you are still, you know, your brain is still working, are there things you do with your body to maybe extend your chances of surviving this and coming out okay?
Yes. It was among the first questions I began to ask these guys was, What do you do? What is it like? And they all say the thing you have to do, and it's hard to imagine, is relax. Because you are not going to overpower it, and so if you don't relax, you're just burning oxygen more quickly. You tuck in your head. You kind of ball up in a little ball. Stay loose, but not so loose that things get dislocated. There was this hilarious moment where this cameraman said to me, I was going on the water, now, if you get hit by a wave, and the waves were about 65 feet that day, if you get hit by a wave, just relax. You know, protect your internal organs, but don't get, you know, you don't want to be too loose and you'll dislocate something. And I was just looking at him like, seriously, I'm hearing this? And but they do survive. And then the flotation vests help them get back to the surface. They can get held down for a wave or two. And I once saw somebody survive a 3-wave hold down on a very big day, which was, nobody believed that could actually be done. And he was very close to death. Because the waves have, when they're that big, they're so long interval, you could be down there for a minute, and a minute in that kind of, most of us can hold our breath for a minute if we're just sitting quietly, but in that kind of maelstrom, it's an eternity.
Did you learn anything about what it takes to capture these images as a photographer? Because that alone is an extraordinary set of skills.
Oh, the photographers, I believe, are some of my favorite characters in the book. I mean, they do a lot of the things the surfers do, but with 100 pounds of equipment strapped around their neck. And they're great watermen themselves. They're all the ones that I traveled with and spent time with. I mean, I just absolutely adored them and wrote a lot about them. And I do think that what they do is incredibly hard and incredibly specific. And, I mean, being a great photographer is hard enough, but then you put the ocean into it, and then you put the stormy ocean into it, and it's just this. There's one of the characters, Don King, who's so mild-mannered, but he was a champion swimmer at Stanford, and he will do stuff that nobody else will do. He's the one who filmed that incredible scene in the movie Castaway where Tom Hanks' plane goes down in the storm.
Yeah.
In order to film that, he had to be in the water in that storm. So to me, I had great respect for them and great affection for them.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next up, we speak with James in Dallas. Hi, James.
Hi. My question is, how do they originally find these places that are so far offshore to surf?
The Cortez Bank was found by a photographer who had been flying around in a private, you know, a small plane and saw, well, first of all, he had heard rumors from fishermen that under certain conditions this wave breaks out there. And so he then chartered a little plane and went out there to see for himself and saw this wave really was there. And so then people started going out in almost an expedition way in boats. And it was first ridden. It really hasn't been surfed for very long. I mean, really only in the past decade have people been going out there to surf it. And I think everybody thinks there are undiscovered waves out there. So they know some of them through either seeing them from shore or hearing about them from mariners, sailors, fishermen. And then there are the unknown waves that I think they're all looking for.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Vicki in Dallas. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. Growing up, I lived at the beach a lot, and I was always told that waves are created by tides. And I'm wondering how much of a, you know, she said that earthquakes and stuff cause these huge waves, but I'm wondering how much the tide influences them.
Well, the tide actually is a kind of a wave. I mean, it's not the kind of wave that I wrote about, but the waves that I wrote about are caused by different disturbances, wind, basically a wave energy being focused in a storm. And, you know, wind is really the short answer to what causes waves, except for tsunamis.
Is there any sense that unexplained shipwrecks might often be due to these events?
Absolutely. There's definitive proof of that, and I write pretty extensively about a couple incidences where the ships were immediately they were sunk so fast by waves that they didn't even have a chance to leave a mayday. And they're in the case of one British ship called the Derbyshire, it went down off the coast of Japan in a typhoon, and these ships go down, these bulk carriers go down at such a rate that, to me, that's one of the reasons I wanted to write the book. I read an article in the New York Times saying it was called The Mystery of the Disappearing Tankers, and it talked about how two large ships a week go missing in the global season. That, to me, that statistic was so extraordinary. I mean, these are large objects. These are the size of a couple football fields, and what's happening to them, and why don't we hear about this? And a lot of the times we don't hear about it because it might be a Liberian ship with a Laotian crew in the Andaman Sea. But the Derbyshire was a British ship, British-owned, brand new, not a rust bucket, went down in a matter of minutes and never left a mayday. And so the British government did extensive inquiries into what happened, sent submersibles down, and amazingly enough found it. And they were able to look at the metal and see the pressures that the metal had gone through in the stern. And the bow were about a mile apart, and the thing had just snapped like a pencil and powered itself to the bottom of the ocean. And the waves had hit from above, which meant they were greater than 80 feet, probably more like 120 feet. Hmm. And they had breached the deck hatches where they used to shuttle cargo in and out, flooded the whole cargo area, smashed the bulkheads, and just it was violent and instant. And there was actual proof of that. And in a couple of instances, they found little pieces of boats, been able to examine the metal. In one instance, two tankers went down within an hour of one another in kind of the same area of the Atlantic in a storm, and they found one guy floating in a lifeboat. So there was enough clues to kind of piece together what was happening. And in particular, there was one type of ship, the design of which made it vulnerable, called a bulk carrier.
You mentioned that this book took you 5 years, your previous book took you 5 years, but this is not even your full-time job. I'm curious about how you go back and forth from the different things that you're working on, how you sort of get back into it when you're moving back into the research phase. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I didn't have a job while I was writing the book. I was working solely on the book, and I went to work on the magazine that I work for now, as I was finishing up The Wave, And I don't know. I've never actually tried to write a book and run a magazine at the same time. So right now, especially a magazine as big and ambitious as I'm writing features for the magazine more than I'm doing book work. And sooner or later, I will find another book. I mean, they really kind of find you in a way. And I just want to keep writing about the ocean. So when I do, I'll have to come cross that bridge when I come to it, because I don't think you can probably do both simultaneously the way I want to.
Do you want to keep writing about scary things?
I want to keep writing about the ocean.
Uh-huh.
And I do think, I don't know about always having it be scary, but I just think it's so fascinating. And I love the concept of the sublime, which is that you have something that is beautiful and terrifying at the same time.
Susan Casey is editor-in-chief of the Oprah Magazine. Her latest book, out now in trade paperback, is called The Wave, In Pursuit of the Rogues, Freaks, and Giants of the Ocean. Susan, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.